Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Dr. Kathy Forte, and we will be talking about her upcoming appearance at the Global Pyramid Conference, where she will be talking about the Atlantean-Egyptian healing connection. And Dr. Forte is a clinical psychologist with more than 25 years of experience in the mental health care field. As a direct result of her near-death experience in 2003, Dr. Forte began working with multidimensional beings to bring forth not only new technology, but a greater understanding of how mankind's origins and evolutionary past are directly linked to the awakening consciousness of today. Dr. Forte is the developer of the Trinfinity 8 healing technology and author of the book Fractals of God, A Psychologist's Near-Death Experience and Journeys into the Mystical. She's also an experienced remote viewer and an ancient Egyptian mystery school teacher who leads annual healing trips through the sacred temples of Egypt. You can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.trinfinity8.com, and that's trinfinity and the number 8.com, and I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. And again, as I mentioned, she will be a speaker at the Global Pyramid Conference, which is happening September 20th through the 23rd at the DoubleTree Hilton in Chicago. And you can find out more about that conference by visiting www.globalpyramidconference.com. And again, I also have a direct link to that conference in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Kathy to the show. Good day, Kathy.
Hi, how are you doing, Robert? Good to talk to you.
I'm doing great, thank you. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you. I always love learning about the mysteries of Egypt and everything that entails that. But we have to start with letting our listeners know a little bit more about you. So you've been a psychologist for more than 25 years, but also you had this near-death experience, which seemed to maybe be the starting point of a little fork in the road for you, maybe. So would you mind sharing with the listeners just a little bit about your journey and that particular experience?
Oh, my gosh, yes. This happened in 2003. You know, you never know how your life is going to turn and what's going to be the pivotal moment and the deciding factor that does it. And basically, I was just finishing work with clients that night, and I was on my way to my car, and I felt this tremendous energy just kind of leave my body through the solar plexus area. And with it, I, you know, felt like, oh my God, what was that? And suddenly I felt like I'd lost all my best friends and that I was done with my work here on Earth as I knew it. And I didn't know what that meant. And I wondered if I was getting ready to die. And if I did, you know, what was this all about? But anyway, I went home. I was able to drive home. And I was sitting down and thinking about what this could mean, because I went into my analytical mode, of course, and the next thing I found myself in a tunnel. It was like a vortex, spinning vortex, and I found myself sucked into this tunnel, horizontal feet first, traveling at a high rate of speed towards this light at the end of the tunnel, and immediately I thought, oh, no, it's the light. Does that mean I died? If I died, what did I die of? I wasn't sick. And but, you know, at some point you realize very quickly, well, if this is my exit plan, there's not much I can do about it now. Let's just go with it. But before I could get into the light, I was stopped, and I came to a halt, and nothing I could do could make me go forward. and I had this irreverent thought that, geez, this is boring. And with that thought, this is boring, all this energy poured into me, spun me back around, sent me back through the tunnel as fast as could be. And I was back in my physical body. My whole left side was paralyzed, and voices were speaking to me in my head, and there was nobody in the room with me, physically in the room with me, and they were telling me to breathe, Kathy, breathe. I was aware that for some reason, my heart had stopped, and they were trying to get me to breathe life back into my physical form. And, of course, I listened because there was not much else I could do. I couldn't move, and I felt them clicking all the parts of me back into place. And as that ended, I had this tremendous pressure in my chest, and I thought, I'm going to have to see a cardiologist. And they told me, no, don't worry about it. Everything will be okay. And from that moment on, my life changed because I found out I had brought back all that feeling of all that stuff coming out of me, I mean, sort of energy, with all my old guidance leaving, and a new set came within the tunnel, very technologically oriented, very kind of geeky in nature. And suddenly I was getting up between 3 and 4 a.m. every morning, and I couldn't go back to sleep unless I was reading everything on the internet they were trying to tell me. And this was all about quantum physics, all about our universe, and they were correcting things. Like, so they said, well, that's not quite right, but that's as far as your understanding, man is understanding of it, and so forth. And this was going on for days and days and days. And interestingly enough, I wasn't tired when I went to see clients the next day, but I was suddenly feeling all of their emotions, which did not feel good. And I realized I'd had some type of shift, so I checked in with a very gifted psychic friend of mine who I didn't tell him what had happened, and he looked behind the scenes and he goes, you brought back a whole bunch of new guides. You know, he said, wow, what happened? But I didn't tell him. I just wanted to, and I said, what do they want? And he says, well, you were sent back because you're going to be doing this type of, it looks like some kind of medical device or some type of electronic device. He said, I can't really. And I said, oh, I don't know anything about inventing or electronics. And he said, no, they're showing me that they will be instrumental in helping you or leading you to the right people. And I just kind of dismissed it, thinking like, okay, well, he's finally wrong. But it became this magnificent obsession. And I finally, when I allowed myself to go with it, then all this information about math and how everything was mathematically coded in the universe, and this all these you know, deep mathematical concepts and so forth. And I thought, why are you showing this to me? Math was my worst. Well, I hated it. So that was the beginning. And it took 5 years to open up the Trinfinity Egg. Yep. I had no idea what I was in for. In fact, I would often say, dear God, please do not send me on a fool's mission here. Because the things that were included were mathematically coded stuff for that. They were teaching me that everything in the universe had a mathematical signature to it. Even our DNA was mathematically coded. And this was back in 2003. And, not something that was on my radar at the time. And they showed that every substance, like even such thing as vitamin C, can be mathematically coded, give it to the body, an algorithm, versus having to physically take it and benefit from it. So this took 5 years. It was between the mathematical codes, between the sacred geometry that was infused in it, certain harmonic sounds they wanted included, and all this had to be transmitted to pure quartz crystal rods, which had to be grown in a lab to transmit all this information through to you from a computer source into your hands, into the body. So, like I said, it sounds way out there, out of the box, but now it's all over the world. So,
yeah, wow.
You just don't
know.
Yeah,
well, No, you don't. No. Now, a very good friend of mine who's a psychic, he often told me that he felt that that his psychic ability was really connected to the math part of his brain, that when he was like 8 and 9 years old, he almost went crazy. He said, multiplying like six-digit numbers by six-digit numbers in his head, and he wouldn't, it's not like he would go through the process of, you know, what we would think about, you know, multiplying. It would, for him, it was in his head, it was like in the old train stations where the numbers, you know, would kind of fall down, this, you know, like little flaps would kind of fall down and kind of, you know, give you the, like, the destination or time. He said that's exactly how it worked for him, starting at, you know, the end number and then just kind of working up to the first number. And he, to this day, he really feels like there's a very strong connection in our brain, you know, between that intuitive aspect and the mathematical, mm-hmm. you know, the part of the brain that deals with mathematics.
Well, all these algorithms they were channeling kind of through to me, you know, were then put into binary codes, zeros and ones, the language of the universe,
oh, wow.
which is computer language. And so, you know, you talk to computer programmers and they go, yeah, because an algorithm is an instruction. It's like a recipe. You take 2 teaspoons of this, you take 4 quarts of this, you take whatever, mix it all together, and then you get where you want. And that's basically mm-hmm. what this was all about. It all broke down from algorithms to binary code, so that many people say, oh, this is really old the old country, what they called Atlantean technology. It's just repackaged in a modern-day form. So, and all yeah. this, like I said, it took 5 years because, you know, they didn't give it to me all at once. I think if they did, I probably would have gone screaming insane in the other direction because, uh-huh. you know, you only get what you, as much as you can handle at a time.
I know. Yeah, you know, I've noticed that. It's like, you know, we're not going to scare you away, and we're not going to tell you where it's going to lead, because otherwise you may not want to go, you know, down that journey. So,
right.
Yeah, I think they're kind of sly when they come to trying to get us to do things. Now
the guides. Well, who are the guides? Yeah, I had to ask that early on, too. Who were these guides? And they call themselves the founders. They said they came from the eighth dimension and beyond. It's a dimension of pure service, Christ consciousness service. And actually, they said that I'd been involved in this work in prior lifetimes. So that the easy way for them to merge with me to do this was in the tunnel, because the tunnel is like an energy conversion device. And it made it much easier. It's much faster in that tunnel than the density of Earth. And so basically they said, you know, you kind of made this decision prior to coming into this lifetime, but you didn't have to do it. There was always, you could have said, you know, there was an out. But the thing is, I think that on some level they must have said, this will always make you look young, energetically young. And I must have said, I'm in. And, you know, today I'm 65 years old and everybody thinks I'm in my late 40s. So, you know, and
amazing.
I haven't
yes.
had any work,
I mean,
in living in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. the capital of, you know, plastic surgery.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I would use the descriptor energetically young. You know, that was the first thing that I saw when I looked at your picture. So I thought that this was not only someone fun, but this was someone who's really going to be really interesting to talk to. So now, when that happened, now how did your book Fractals of God? Apparently, it's a book about that experience and your start of your past. So tell us a little bit about the book and how the inspiration.
I saw how I was being prepped from early on from my childhood growing up for this time in my life. Of course, it wasn't apparent to me till after the fact. But, you know, I'd had very unusual experiences as a child and some psychic, although I did not classify myself as intuitive or psychic in any realm. You know, it wasn't like I could do palm readings or, you know, or readings for people.
Mm-hmm.
Like that just wasn't my thing. But I was highly intuitive. And you know, I saw that even at one time, you know, I had made some type of asking the universe to be of service in some way. And you better be prepared. If you ask for it, you know, you'll find that they will somewhere down the line come knocking on your door. And it's time to come forth. And but it was there was a long kind of haul in between. And there was a really interesting story. I'll tell it to you now, is that years ago in New York, I used to be, before I became a therapist, I was a journalist, and I worked in CBS News in New York, and at one time I was doing a story with children at the New York City Ronald McDonald House that had just opened. These were for kids who had cancer. And while I was there, I had this amazing dream, and in the dream, I saw this little girl who had come to the Ronald McDonald House. Her name was Fernanda, and she'd come from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And she was just very blue-eyed, you know, blonde-haired, very angelic. She didn't speak any English, but her mother spoke some English. And one day they were there, the next day they were gone. And I figured they must have gotten some bad news from Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital about her treatment, and then decided to maybe go home to Brazil. But in the dream, I saw that I was in the hospital room, and little Fernanda was sleeping in the bed with emerald green pajamas, and I was looking at her, and a voice behind me, who I could not see in the dream, said, you need to go see her, and you have a message for her. And I remember saying to the voice, but I don't speak Portuguese. and the voice was saying, it doesn't matter. And that was the end of the dream. It ended very abruptly. I got up the next morning, and I'm thinking, is she in Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital? I have no idea. So I called the hospital, and sure enough, she was on the patient roster. She had just had a bone marrow transplant operation. She was in reverse isolation, which meant that she had no immunity to anything. So anyone visiting her had to put the cap, the gown, the booties, the whole nine yards on, so for protection. And so I went to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital thinking, like, I don't know what I'm supposed to say. Is she getting ready to die? Do I have some words of comfort for, you know, I had no idea. It's like an actor getting ready to go on the stage and does not know what their lines are. So I get up there, and I put on the cap, the gown, the booties, open the door, and the mother comes to the door. She recognizes me, and she says, oh, come in. And I see Fernanda sleeping in the bed, just as I had in the dream, with emerald green pajamas. And I thought, oh, okay. And so the mother told me that they had found out that she needed a bone marrow transplant. They had moved out of Ronald's house, got an apartment, sends for the little boy and the father from Brazil to see if they were a match, and so forth. And she asked me, why did you decide to come here today? And I thought, you know, do I tell her the whole truth? Because I don't really know why I'm here. And she said, I kind of had a dream that I should go visit her. I didn't say anything more than that. And all of a sudden, the phone rings, and she picks it up immediately so as not to wake Fernanda, and it's her husband. And she's talking in rapid Portuguese, and she's starting to cry and get all emotional. I'm thinking, oh, no, must be bad news. And she gets off the phone, and I said, is everything okay? What's the matter? And she said, I was just talking to my husband, and I told him that you came to visit us. And he said that he had been praying to God for a sign that Fernanda would get through the operation okay and would go on to have, a good life. And the sign he asked for, since they knew no one in the United States, was an unexpected visitor.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, my gosh. No wonder I didn't need to speak the language. I just needed to show up, talk about a dummy, a fool. I mean, you just send me. And that's all I had to do, was just show up. And I thought about all the variables in this master universal computer that had to be clicked all into place to get me to be there, to be their sign. And it was funny because around that time my life was changing, and I was kind of asking for signs, and I got my sign, and which I won't go into. And I thought, well, maybe in the scheme of things, then I had to be somebody else's sign. So that taught me to really pay attention to dreams, because you just don't know how important they may be in the scheme of your life. And so that was the first thing prior to that I'd been asking, can I be of some service? And so that was my first test. But I guess I must have passed that one.
I think so. I think there you go. Yeah, exactly. Now that you did that, we can download a whole bunch of information. Well, you know, and see the beauty of that. And I'm a very strong proponent of, you know, the dream realm and the information that we can get and how it can guide us. And, you know, in that particular one, you know, the idea of just showing up, you know, and just following through is just so important. I think so many people would have discarded, you know, that and not taken that little added effort. And especially if you didn't know what you were going to say. I mean, you know, you have a message and you don't know what to say. I mean, it's like, okay, wait a minute. This doesn't make sense. Why would I do that? But
sometimes you just
know,
have to sit quietly and wait until you're given the next direction. And, you know, it did work. I knew that, you know, after I invented the Trinfinity 8 technology, that I had to kind of put it all together in the book, Fractals and God. You know, and because how, you know, not only sacred geometry, but they taught me about how fractals can be very instrumental in the healing process. And so all this stuff that I had no idea. And people kept asking me for, you know, some of my findings and so forth, or what I was learning. And so I just decided, you know, most people write the book and not the technology, maybe later. I did it backwards. I did the technology, then I wrote the book to try to help people understand it, you know, so.
Well, you know, it worked for you, you know, and you know, you can, I mean, there are systems that work sometimes, but sometimes you just, no, it just has to work the other way around. You buck the system. But
absolutely.
Can you explain exactly about fractals, what a fractal is, and you know, therefore the title Fractals of God?
Yeah, well, you know, everything in the universe has kind of a fractal scheme to it. You know, if you look at ram's horns, flowers, it's the fractal pattern of how they grow, even inside the capillary systems of human beings. The blood system looks very fractal in nature. If I look at a tree and it's not growing in a sequence, sort of like Fibonacci sequence of cycle of growth, and it's all chaotic, I can tell that it's sick. That the fractal pattern of it is actually disintegrating, breaking down the health and of the tree. So the fractals are like, if you look at those Russian matryoshka dolls, a doll within a doll within a doll,
right.
All parts contain the whole, with maybe just slight variations. But if you use fractals with the science of algorithms and math, and you put those two together, the fractals then become an amplifier of the information codes coming through. That I didn't understand until my guidance explained that to me. So, you know, we run them, you know, we have a fractal on the screen, but you don't have to look at the fractal because our codes are running right behind the fractal, and they set up what they call almost like an energetic force field. So you can feel that around the computer even without seeing it. Some people are all of a sudden drawn over there, and then, you know, when we do shows or so forth like that, and they said, you know, I just felt drawn over to here, and because they're kind of interlapping with that fractal energetic field. So that's kind of like the really abbreviated version of fractal science.
Well, yeah,
just so people's eyes don't roll back in their head at this point.
Well, yeah, you know, they can get the book and get more detail. But you know,
yeah,
it's interesting.
It's more
detail in the book. Yeah, well, you know, and it's just the idea. I mean, when you get into the, you know, sacred geometry aspect of, you know, of creation, you know, and all of, you know, and all of its, you know, forms, it kind of makes you sit back and look at. I mean, it's really wondrous. I mean, you know, I mean, without a better word, I mean, it's just amazing that it can be so uniform in a way, but yet, you know, be the basis of so much variety of life.
Yeah. There are very few women out there who actually have done energetic devices. In fact, when some people usually see this one, they go, without knowing the information behind it, they go, you know, this is laid out so simply. Was this designed by a woman? Because, you know, men like the bells and whistles. They have to make it, you know, go down. It's almost as if you're going down Alice in Wonderland, the tunnel, this and that complicated. And I thought, you know, it doesn't have to be complicated. Simplicity is best, and people can understand this. So it landed up having 72 different programs that dealt with spirituality, that dealt with physical problems, with restoration problems, anti-aging, emotional release problems. So, you know, we started having therapists from all over the world. And some were, you know, some were psychiatrists, some were psychologists, some were Reiki masters, some were acupuncturists, some massage therapists. I've had some plastic surgeons use it to speed up, you know, surgery, healing after surgery. So they didn't actually come with an instruction manual. We got it. So half the time, it was those first pioneers using it who saw that it was doing things they didn't expect, and they would report back to me, and I said, really, you did that? And so they've been the ones who've really been able to help decipher this technology and all that it's good for. So, but this is what led me to Egypt. You know,
well, that
I knew that I had lifetimes there, and that, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, princess this or princess that, you know, that I worked behind the scenes, I was told. You know,
there you go.
And, you know, nobody of noteworthy importance, you know, except I was told that many would know your work, but not your name. So,
okay. Well, you know, that's a perfect lead in. We're gonna take a real quick break, Kathy, and then we'll come back. Let's go ahead and then move or shift into that Egypt connection, and maybe talk a little bit about the topic that you'll be discussing at the Global Pyramid Conference. And then I have a couple other questions. So we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back in about 90 seconds, okay?
Sounds good.
Great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hello. This is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store. Or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone. Thank you for staying with us again today. My very special guest is Dr. Kathy J. Forte, and we are talking about her journey, her work, her invention, the Trinfinity 8. You can find out more by visiting her website, which is trinfinity8.com, and it's TRINFINITY and the number 8.com. And again, I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. And also, again, Kathy is going to be a speaker at the Global Pyramid Conference coming up on September 20th through the 23rd in Chicago. And again, I do have a direct link to that conference in the show page description. And that website is www.globalpyramidconference.com. And when she is there, she'll be speaking about the Atlantean Egyptian healing connection. Okay, so that we're back, Kathy.
Hi.
Hey. Okay, so that you said that kind of led you to Egypt. So tell us about how that all came about. Are the founders Egyptians or Atlanteans?
Well, they were not in this particular. They're a non-physical realm, and they've always stayed in non-physical. And you know, maybe at one time years ago they were, but you know, they've kind of moved on up. You might say they're not doing their work on third dimension, fourth dimensional Earth here, because they've passed that stage. And so basically, it was telling me that I needed to kind of return to my roots, and that I would, a lot of what I was doing, they were helping me to re-remember what I've already done. And this led back to the Atlanteans, the Atlantic period. Now, you know, so much of man's history has been either lost, hidden, or cloaked in myth. And we have no idea how many times we've started, we've maybe had catastrophes or so forth like that, that kind of brought man back to square one and starting all over again. And much of that history, like I said, has been lost, or is just now, maybe it was a myth, you know, like Plato talked about Atlantis and so forth like that. But I actually started to, so I was told I needed to return to Egypt. And so the first time I went was, I was booked to go in February 2011, and 2 weeks, obviously, before I was ready to leave, Egypt erupted in chaos and had their Arab Spring uprising. So that put the kibosh on that one. And I thought, okay, well, the timing's not right. And so I waited and waited a couple of years and went back. And it was perfect because for me, no one was in any of the temples. You know, they were still afraid of going. And, I mean, now things have almost returned back to its pre-Arab Spring uprising, you know, tourist place. But then it was like I had all the temples to myself without inside interference. And all of these impressions could come in and flood in and awaken what I had once, what I had once been involved in. And I came to see that I was that the Atlanteans, you know, everybody thinks, oh, the Egyptians suddenly had all of this technology, all of this writing, all of these arts, all of these building, you know, sciences and math and knowledge, all just sprung out of them from nowhere, like there was no evolution. And what they didn't take into account was the fact that, you know, Atlantis has had three different upheavals. Our planet has gone through some serious catastrophes in the past. And, you know, one of them was, Atlantis was from an asteroid hitting, one was from an earthquake, and the last one was the final deluge or flood, which kind of put things over the edge, and many lives were lost. But the seers, the profiteers, not profiteers, but the ones who had the prophetic knowledge could see the writing on the wall, and they needed to preserve this knowledge. So many of them from the higher sects, the priestesses, and who the teachers with the knowledge, started migrating to Egypt. And they didn't do it, you know, they had already started because Atlantis had many colonies all over the earth. Antarctica was one of them. You know, that's why they're starting to think, oh, was Antarctica Atlantis? No, it wasn't, but it was one of their colonies. Egypt was one of their colonies. So they already started feeding this knowledge in different places. South America, another really, really big one, the Mayans, the Incans, the Peru, everything there, you know, comes from Atlantean wisdom. And if you look through a lot of the old histories of some of these South American tribes, they all talked about their ancestors coming from the seas and in places called Atlan, or Atlia, or something like that, and they all sound very close to Atlantis in name, and you find this kind of all over the world. Well, there was a special sect of priests called the Order of Melchizedek. These were the cosmic priests to the priests, and these guys were, you know, very many shades above the common priest or priesthood, which sometimes during that time could be, during the Egyptian time, some of them were a questionable lot, to put it mildly, you know. They weren't
always
pious, and some things never change, right? And so much of this knowledge was the idea to return to source. And I kind of look at Earth as one big experiment. Basically, can we come back in without our memory of our perfection and being one with source? Experience, have all these unusual experiences that we've chosen, you know, to learn and grow from and to return back to source, you know, without being deterred. Now, some of us, you know, have taken a little bit of the, you know, path, gotten off the path, but it doesn't mean that they can't get back on. All of this is a learning process. It's not sort of like you did bad or your karma or something like this. It's just a learning process. In fact, I look at what's going on in our world right now and I just sit back, observe it all. It's nothing but kabuki theater, you know. Don't have hate in your heart. Just look at it and say, you know, we all have orchestrated this as a learning process between dark and light and growth and discernment and oneness and knowing that, you know, as they say, where we go one, we go all. But anyway, so they had the Temple Beautiful in Egypt, and this was, you know, a place where they focused on perfecting and having to go through 12 different stations of obstacles and trials and so forth to shed, you know, fear and doubt and the ego and really tune into things. So, you know, lots of things that they used, they were very good at soul retrieval and soul problems with soul fracturing. And it's funny because in this lifetime as a therapist, my specialty was multiple personality disorder. And which is now called, well, back then it was called multiple personality disorder. Now it's called dissociative identity disorder. But these are, you know, pretty much fractured souls. And here I was like, oh, here I am doing this again, you know.
Wow.
But in modern day psychology. And, you know, they addressed all these healing modes using dreams and water ceremonies and sound and crystals and colors and herbs and special sacred oils and energy. You know, all of this stuff was a part of the process. It was, the whole idea was to restore the soul, because once one restored the soul from any injury, so forth like that, one could merge in back into oneness. So, it wasn't a process that happened overnight, obviously. Some, you know, still backslid, and sort of like addiction therapy, some backslide has to come back and keep doing it. But all of this was quite incredible. And I also, you know, last time I was in Egypt was in March of this year. I lead a group there for 2 weeks, usually out of every year. These are usually soul journey searchers, you know. It's not your normal tourist type of group to Egypt. And what I got to do there, and I didn't bring the group there because I didn't think it was safe enough to do it, was the first time I was in Egypt, I had astrally traveled when I was in the king's chamber and suddenly saw myself traveling down through the pyramid, not up. And I could see where all the tunnels were. I flew out the Sphinx's head, which I didn't know until later, does have a hole at the top of the head, and found out that the head is somewhat hollow, and saw underneath the pyramid there was all this water. And there was like a lake, and that fascinated me. So I finally, with my Egyptologist guide and I, we were able to kind of bribe the Egyptian government into allowing us to go down there. And everything's negotiable, I say, in Egypt. And, you know, now they're opening it to the public once they realize that they could put a price on it, I'm sure. But you, underneath the pyramid, you go down like about a little bit more than 125 feet, three different levels, and you get down to, you're going down iron-runged ladders, and you get down to the bottom there, and there is a lake down there, and there's a sarcophagus buried in the water there, and there are tunnels. And water tunnels throughout, under the causeway, underneath the pyramids, and so forth. Now, these tunnels, when I started to really do some research, found that there's tunnels, water tunnels, built under some of the biggest pyramids elsewhere in the world as well. Chichen Itza, the Kokolkan pyramid temple there, they found a lake underneath it, runs east-west, and the Bosnian pyramids have water tunnels under them. And some of the other tunnels, South America, said they have water tunnels. And if they don't have water tunnels, because maybe the water has dried up at this point, they do have a series of cavern tunnels. So, you know, you have to start asking yourself, what were all these tunnels about? And did these tunnels precede the building of the pyramids? Obviously, mm-hmm. they had to. And what were they doing with it? And so that led me into a different thing, which I'll be talking about at conference as well, you know, why they use these particular water tunnels.
That as well. So, now, I'm just curious, and hopefully I won't tread too much on your talk, but, I mean, has there been an identified source of the water? I mean...
interesting, because I took water samples. I did take water samples when I was down there. I was prepared, and I had them analyzed at a lab here in California, and they told me that the water was salinated. It was salt water, but not the kind of salt water that would come from the Mediterranean, not that level of salt that would you get from a large salt water lake or ocean or something. And, of course, the Nile is a freshwater source. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to use it to for their plants and everything else. You can't use salt water to grow, you know, vegetables and other stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, where is this water coming from that's salty? And, you know, we looked at the rocks. Is it coming off the rocks? And it was trying to, you know, the analysis showed that, no, it couldn't have been coming off the rocks. So I started looking around for sources of, is there any saltwater sources that are nearby there? Because the Nile River is 5 miles from Giza Plateau. 5 miles. I mean, because after the Aswan Dam was built, everything, you know, it reached. But in ancient times, that water actually came right up to the pyramid, you know.
Okay.
And that's why you also see the water erosion around the Sphinx there. You know,
it must
have been under.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I found 50 miles northeast of Cairo, is a lake called Lake Moeris. And this was interesting. It was a prehistoric lake, a pre-dynastic, I should say, meaning before, you know, they started counting the pharaohs and stuff, or at least most of them that we don't know about. And it was originally a freshwater lake that somehow turned saltwater. And it doesn't say. I couldn't find why it had turned salty. I mean, maybe it was from erosion, runoff, mixing, or something like that. We're not sure. Nobody knows. But, you know, legend has it that, right near it was a big complex of the pyramid, Hawara complex, that's Hawara. And in ancient times, it was known that this one had very close links with the Giza Plateau Great Pyramid complex. So it was kind of was like a underground water subway system, and I believe that they used it for specific underworld rituals and so forth like that. But, you know, how extensive it is under the Giza Plateau, we don't know. The Egyptian government is not saying if they do know. As for the sarcophagus buried under the water down in the lake there, they told me no one's been able to open it or it hasn't been opened, which I find odd that somebody would try to open it or something. You know, but half the time I think that, you know, sometimes the Egyptians are a little afraid of what they may find. You know, either it's hidden
yeah.
or because everything can't go back further than 4,000 years or it kind of nullifies Allah and the Islam religion. And so you
mm-hmm.
have to be kind of careful. And as we know, Edgar Cayce talked about that the pyramids were, you know, built anywhere between 10,500 years ago to 12,000 years ago, which would have been the last decline of Atlantis was about 13,000 years ago. So a lot of this goes back further, and the Sphinx and the tunnels, I'm sure, preceded it. The pyramids. So we you know,
yeah.
when you discover one thing, it brings up, you know, at least 10 more questions. And some of it my guides have told me what, and some of it they said, you know, this is some of it you need to kind of keep to yourself right now. And some of it, yeah, you can talk about. And so, you know, we'll see where we go with this.
Yeah, that's just fascinating.
Hours, you know?
Well, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's fascinating, you know, and when I first heard about that, when talking to Marta, the coordinator for the conference, she mentioned that. And the first thing that popped in my mind was that it was, you know, they've often talked about, you know, the pyramids as possibly being some kind of energy generation, some kind of energy mm-hmm. source. And boy, you know, salt water underneath could really, you know, rev up that engine, so to speak. You know, so
I think its original purpose was as a device, an energy device. And then, you know, over the years after it was like a piano out of tune when the capstone was removed, then it was used for rituals and so forth. And to this day, I believe the capstone is really still inside the pyramid. That capstone is quartz, it's gold. And doing a remote viewing inside, this was before they started scanning the pyramids during the scanpyramids.org project. And I said, there's one part above the Grand Gallery that I kept seeing what looked like a tiny miniature pyramid. And I didn't know what that was, but I have a feeling that the capstone is inside that. And I think that if the government does go up, because they found when they did the Scan Pyramids project later on, they found that there was a hollow space above the Grand Gallery where it, you know, it doesn't come to a complete point up there, and it's sort of like somebody put a false ceiling. And we'll see. You know, they put the kibosh on going through and opening certain things in the past. And, you know, it's at the stage now, if it's not a native Egyptian archaeologist that finds it, they don't want any more foreigners coming in and taking credit. So, you know,
yeah.
this has been a problem.
Yeah, there's
and
a lot
the reason,
of,
you know.
You know yeah, well, you know, in a lot of their national identity, you know, is tied, you know, to the pyramids and the, you know, the history and all of that kind of thing. So I could understand why they want to try and direct it, you know, as much as possible, you know, keeping that identity intact. And also, like when you mentioned about when it comes to religion and what they may learn and how it may counter religion, you know, that's, I think, that's why a lot of things are being silenced
yeah.
in support of those structures.
It would rewrite,
you know,
man's
because
history.
Once,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you know,
go ahead.
I have a friend who was working on the Bosnian pyramid, you know, in Croatia. And they said when they first started, all of a sudden they were getting not only people from Egyptian government looking to see, because the Bosnian pyramid, it looks like it goes back 10,000-12,000 years from what they can date of it, and it's bigger, you know, so they're thinking like, oh, we don't want somebody to leave the tourist industry anymore. And interesting that they found that that CIA was coming around too. So everybody has kind of an interest in what could be hidden here. And we don't maybe want it to be come out, or we have to be careful
right.
on what comes out and so forth like that. You know, it's a secret state. So So God only knows what has been hidden that's already been found.
I know, yeah. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, from, you know, the circles that I travel, and I'm sure that you travel, the idea of, you know, let it all out, you know, let us know, we really want to know.
Yeah.
And we're confident in our structures, you know, but there truly are a lot of people out there who would blow a gasket,
Yeah, I think so. That's why I think that, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes you just have to give it out in little tiny pieces, you know, not just inundate mm-hmm. a person with it. So you kind of get them used to it. It's sort of like, you know, even our government currently talking about the fact is that we're going to have a space force, you know. Well, you know, I believe mm-hmm. that the Space Force is kind of to preempt the secret space programs that they have so they can kind of slowly come up to speed, you know, on what the American people mm-hmm. know, because most everybody believes that, you know, that we aren't the only planet that's inhabited out there. And I'm sure the Atlanteans
yeah.
had space brothers, too, that they communicated with. You know, and before Atlantis, there was the Lemurian civilizations as well. So, you know, I kind of take a little bit of when people say, oh, no, the aliens had to have built the pyramids. And I say, I'm sure that some of them may have come around and visited, but, you know, the ancient Atlanteans were master concrete builders, and everybody thinks that the Romans were the ones that invented concrete. They weren't. And the Atlanteans knew how to mix certain formulas so that would look exactly like stone and precast molds. But if you open up sometimes some of those blocks that look perfect, you might see some air bubbles in them, that they aren't solid.
Wow. Yep.
So it
Absolutely.
Gives you something to think about.
It sure does. It sure does. Now, you touched on something when you were in the King's Chamber. You talked about remote viewing. Well, that was, I think, astral travel. But you're an experienced remote viewer. So I'm curious, how did that come about?
How did
that
happen?
That kind of, yeah.
I lived in Northern California at one time, and I was invited to a New Year's Eve party. And one of the people at the party was Russell Targ. And were ones involved mm-hmm. in the remote viewing for the CIA, the Stanford Research Project. And he was at this thing, got to talking, and I'd heard something about this. And I said, well, you know, how do you find these people? And, you know, isn't it hard to learn and so forth? He goes, no, it's really easy to learn how to do this, you know. And so a number of us were talking. He said, well, will you teach us? And so we, not at the party, but outside the party at
right.
some place,
mm-hmm.
he did teach us. And so I started to use it. I mean, I don't use it prolifically, but once in a while I'll kind of dust something out to look, you know, see if I can find something. I'm saying a blanket statement now. I stay away from military installations and everything else. <you know?
laughs>
But that's how I saw that there was something that a little miniature pyramid inside the Great Pyramid. But when I was inside the King's Chamber, the first time I was in there was with three other people. They had all been there before, and I was the only newbie, and this lifetime. And I was laying down in the sarcophagus, and suddenly I just started toning, you know, because it's like this wonderful resonance chamber, especially when you're in the sarcophagus. And so I started doing that, and suddenly I saw in my mind's eye, the lid slammed shut over the sarcophagus. Now, in real life, there is no lid there, but I saw this in my mind's eye, and suddenly that moment of panic, like, oh, God, I'm buried alive here, you know, I'm sealed shut.
Right.
And
right.
my guide said to me, you know what to do. And apparently I didn't know what to do, because immediately I slowed down my breathing and got into this kind of trance state, and I could feel myself hovering slightly above, and it was sort of like a cellular memory of it. And the next thing I knew, the sarcophagus bottom had opened up, and I was sliding a chute down into the bowels of the pyramid, and a part of me was saying, I thought I was supposed to ascend up, not down.
Wow.
In the scheme of things, you know, before you can ascend, you have to go through the trials and tribulations of the underworld. You know?
Yeah.
So it did make sense, but of course I didn't know that at the time, and that's when I saw, you know, the water down there, the tunnels, you know, the extents of the entrances that ran from the Sphinx to the pyramid and so forth. And I think it was in a different time zone, because I know some of those tunnels have been plugged up, you know. And so I think that I just did a little timeline shift there and remembered, because it was my guide saying, you know what to do. And so I think I just reverted back to a prior lifetime time where I didn't know what to do.
Amazing. Russell Targ was, I spoke to him probably about 4 years ago about his book, The Reality of ESP. It was one of my most favorite interviews. I love speaking with him, and I follow him on Facebook. So I kind of, you know, I mean, he's a very interesting man, and the work that he did is, I mean, to me, you know, that his scientific approach to, you know, ESP and remote viewing, to me, is one of those classic works to bridge the gap, you know, between science and, you know, the paranormal or you know, extra, you know, science beyond what we can see. So, I love him. So,
and when I met him, it was early within 2000. I think it might have been 2001 or something, but it was like, you know, 17, 18 years ago or so. So, you know, I have been kind of out of contact with him. But, you know, once you learn that, you know, and like I said, it's if you practice it, you become a lot more proficient at it. So so it seems to come in play every now and then for me. And I'm always amazed at, you know, what information I do get. But it's usually always for a reason. You know, it's not for just sightseeing.
Yeah, which is one of those tools in that toolbox. You know, when it's necessary, it comes out to be used. So,
absolutely. I mean, I had a therapy practice, there were times I had some clients that were like unbelievably difficult, and inside I would say, I don't know what to do. What do I do? And then something would pop into my head, and the answer, and I would try it, and it worked. And so, you know, all those tools that we have in divine inspiration that we're all plugged into, you know, some people call it the Akashic Records, the collective unconscious or so forth like that, you know, we all have access to it. We don't have to have necessarily any special training or be special or elevated beings or anything else like that. We all can tune into it if we so desire.
Absolutely. Well, Kathy, this has really been fun, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you. And
thank you.
And I really want to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure.
And I hope everybody comes to the Global Pyramid Conference.
How did you take the words out of my mouth? The dates are September 20th through the 23rd. And again, for listeners, there is a direct link to that conference in the website description, the show page description, www.globalpyramidconference.com. And again, today, my very special guest has been Dr. Kathy Forte. We've been talking about her her book, Fractals of God, and about her journey, her NDE, and about the topic that she will be speaking about at the conference, the Atlantean-Egyptian Healing Connection. And again, all of that information is in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And until we meet again...
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.